Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour, an editorial review. Now, The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour, an editorial review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, about news, and about current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the common law right after this message. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. Government gets 60%. Now, that's $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just kind of special? And if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes, just like you did this year, and you're going to net 25%, and the government's going to net about 75%. Now, that means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more. That's 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year. You produce twice as much, and you get 8% of it. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Now, that's called communism. That's called the heavy progressive income tax. Now, why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much and receive so little. To order your free general law CD package, just call direct and order yours today. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967, or go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine. georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Tax and Status School is also available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. Why don't you call right now before you forget? All right, last time we took up the subject of the common law. What is it? Where does it come from? And I told you about my student Ted came into my office one day and said, you know, we need to get more into the common law. I said to Ted, well, what is the common law? He didn't know. I didn't know. I said, go get a 5-gallon bucket, Ted, fill it up with common law, bring it in here, set it on the desk, and you and I will get into it right up to our elbows, right up to our armpits, and we'll kind of squish it through our fingers a little bit so that we can learn more about this common law. I hear people talk about that every once in a while. I often wonder to myself, do they really know what they're talking about? So last time I introduced you to the origin of the common law. It comes from the Mosaic Code. It comes from the Ten Commandments. It's the opposite to the law that we practice here in the United States called the Roman Civil Law. You know, we got our Roman Senate, we got our United States Senate. We've got our state senates. We have our Roman architecture. That's the way we construct and build our buildings. Our government is designed after the Roman civil government. Our laws are predicated upon the laws of Hammurabi's Code, which was the precursor to the Roman system of law. In opposition to that Roman system of law is the Ten Commandments, the law of God, the Mosaic Law. It's a different code, different system. We used to practice that code and system here in the United States. It was codified, remember, by Alfred the Great in 872 A.D. And our English forefathers brought it over here. You know, people like the Pilgrims and the Jamestown colonists and the English, you know, brought it over here to the New World, and we Canadians and Americans and Australians and New Zealand people use it because that's what we were always taught. And I showed you Alfred the Great, you know, actually cited from the Bible right in Alfred's Dooms. 22 of those principles of law are contained in our federal constitution here in the United States. So when we look at the law in general, historically, the early American common law came from the Anglo-Saxon common law in England. and it existed, controlled, and ruled the land of England prior to the reign of William the Conqueror, who conquered England in 1066 when he conquered the Anglo-Saxons. The common law was basically the golden rule, as stated, "Do not unto others as you would not have others do unto you." After William the Conqueror, the golden rule was changed to "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." You can readily see the first as the higher form of the rule. And when the Anglo-Saxon tribes migrated from northern Germany to Denmark, they brought the common law with them. In fact, when the early priests who had come to Denmark to convert the Germans to Christianity, when they returned, they said, "These people do not need the law. They are already practicing the law." What were they practicing? Who were these priests? These people were already practicing the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. And when they came to convert them to Christianity, they said, "Hey, these people don't need it. They're already practicing it." Now, some writers profess that Jesus Christ actually taught the common law in Denmark on a lake where the word law allegedly originated. In any event, the common law stems from Scripture, wherein God recorded His law. Today, we call it the Ten Commandments. The best way to explain what this common law is to explain, first of all, what it is not. There are fundamentally two competing systems of man-made law on planet Earth, and they are in constant ideological conflict against one another. One is called the common law, the other is called the Roman civil law. The civil law. Both of these laws are divided into two forms. We have civil actions and criminal actions. So under the Roman civil law, you have criminal actions and civil actions or civil suits. Under the common law, you have criminal actions and you have civil actions. So both of them work the same way in that regard. J. Reuben Clark, a former U.S. Under Secretary of State and Ambassador to Mexico, succinctly stated the principles and applications of these two systems of law when Clark wrote, quote, "Briefly and stated in general terms, the basic concept of these two systems was as opposite as the poles. In the civil law, the sources of all law is the personal ruler, whether he's a prince, a king, or an emperor. He is sovereign. In the common law, certainly as finally developed in America, the source of all law is the people. They as a whole are sovereign, and during the centuries, these two systems have had an almost deadly rivalry for the control of society, the civil law in its fundamental concepts being the instrument through which ambitious men of genius and selfishness have set up and maintained despotisms, whereas the common law, with its basic principles being the instrument through which men of equal genius, but with love of mankind burning their souls, have established and preserved liberty and free institutions. The Constitution of the United States embodies the loftiest concepts yet framed of this exalted concept." Unquote. Now that's J. Reuben Clark. Notice he didn't give any credit to God. He didn't say anything about God and the Ten Commandments or the Mosaic Law. He just said, well, the loftiest principles of men that love their fellow man gave us our Constitution, our Bill of Rights. And, well, in any event, you can see that these two forms of law, civil and common, are at loggerheads with one another. The American heritage of freedom is a direct result of the common law, which derived its authority solely from usages and customs of immemorial antiquity. The common law is the legal embodiment of practical sense, and its guiding star has always been the rule of right and wrong, called the Golden Rule. Our founding fathers wrote a declaratory trust known as the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson listed 18 grievances, and in each one of these grievances, he showed how we were being denied our rights as free-born Englishmen. The Declaratory Trust was an appeal to the nations of the world. that the acts that were being committed against the laws of nations and the Declaration of Independence became an ordinance, a public trust within the law of nations. Now, the English people had a simple and pure common law of individual rights and property rights. But there also existed alongside of it another type of law, a law that was as old as the common law, the law of commerce, the law of maritime law. The earliest recorded knowledge of maritime law is in the Isle of Rhodes, about 900 B.C. There also existed the laws of Oleron, the laws of the Hanseatic League of Germany, Hamburg, Germany, which were merely reiterations of the earlier civil laws. The Romans had their maritime law, which was their basic civil law. This was the law of commerce, whereas the common law was the law that had to do with land and with the people living on the land. Historically, the common law has only dealt with land, labor, and substance. When William the Conqueror conquered England in 1066 AD, he subjugated all of the Saxons to his rule. But there was one part of England that he was not able to conquer, and that was London Town. The merchants had a wall around London Town, and they brought their ships carrying food up to their facilities and they unloaded them. William built the White Tower to look down on the city to see why his men were losing. He finally decided that he was not going to take London Town and that his control was slipping. So he went to the merchants and he asked them, "Just what is it that you people want?" And the merchants said, "We want the maritime law. We want the merchant's law." In those days, they called it Lex Mercantoria, and William said, "You have it." And to this day, 2005 AD, the inner city of London has its own special law where the merchant's law is practiced. Even Queen Elizabeth does not enter London Town unescorted to this day. In 1215 AD at Runnymede, the barons in England made King John sign the Magna Carta, which became the basic document espousing fundamental rights of the English people to this day. Most American colonists were very well schooled in the common law, and because many of them were merchants and traders, they also knew the merchant's law. They knew the king and parliament were forcing the admiralty jurisdiction upon them, and this finally forced them to revolt. The admiralty system of law practiced on the continent of Europe, in contradistinction to the common law of England, was called civil law, also known as the Roman civil law, which is derived from the law of the ecclesiastical chancellors. Now, this is partly the ancient law of Rhodes, the law of merchant traders upon commercial documents. In the civil law, prosecution is by the chancellor, who is not an impartial referee of the dispute. This civil law was never part of the laws of England and has never been declared as laws of the realm by the Parliament, nor by many experts of English jurisprudence, such as Coke, Blackstone, or John Fortescue. I might point out at this juncture, the other day I was watching 60 Minutes, and that old segment on there about credit cards. And one of the things that most people didn't understand about their credit cards is that if there's a dispute that comes up, they go to what's called binding arbitration. In other words, you can't sue Visa or MasterCard. And that's because there's a clause in the contract that bars it and subjects you to the Roman civil law practice of a chancellor, binding arbitration, rather than a jury of your peers. You see, the common law is predicated upon going to the congregation. So God instructed us in the jury system, both grand juries and petit juries. The jury system comes from the law of Moses. It doesn't come from the Roman civil law. The Romans practiced an emperor dictatorship. Limited government and property and property rights are hallmarks of the Ten Commandments, and the basic law, the basic rule of personal private property rights is thou shalt not steal. Without the law that says thou shalt not steal, you can't own personal private property. So the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto abrogate thou shalt not steal with the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property and land. Boys and girls, all property, all material goods come out of the land. They come out of the soil. Iron ore comes out of the soil. Your automobile came out of the ground. The table that you're sitting at, the telephone that you speak on, the materials that you use in your house, everything there came out of the ground. The carpet that you're walking on is a petroleum extract that came out of an oil well. All wealth comes out of the ground. And if you're going to have property and property rights, then you have to be able to own, use, and control that property to the exclusion of everybody else in the universe, including God Almighty Himself. In fact, that's one of the definitions of property, is the exclusion of God, anybody else in the universe, from the use of it. Now, as English society developed over the years, situations arose for which the courts of common law could provide no relief by any precedent. The controversies did not involve property. The controversies didn't include property or substance. The only recourse was to petition the king, who delegated his first minister to solve these problems. The minister was called a chancellor, and the relief granted was called equity. This equity meant what would be fair if the common law principles were extended and applied to the case at bar. What would be fair and equitable? Now, Solomon had a case of equity. Two women were contesting the ownership of a child. Two women had babies, and one of the babies died. The woman whose baby died claimed that the woman whose baby was alive was hers. And so the case finally came to the king, and the king came up with the famous edict, cut the living baby in two and divide it. Whereupon the real mother of the living baby said, no, no, don't kill the child to give me half. Give the living child to this other woman. Solomon then recognized that this is the mother of the child, the one who said, let it live. The other one said, good, cut it in half and give me my half. So Solomon came up with a precedent in equity, which we deal with today, called the best interests of the child. Best interests of the child. So as a result, there developed in England and America two distinct systems of law and two distinct judicial systems, each having a peculiar and particular application and jurisdiction. Equity jurisdiction is designated in personam jurisdiction, a jurisdiction in which the individual does not have any rights, and one in which the individual can be subjected only if he volunteers or gives his informed consent. This is called contract. Now, all law is predicated upon contract. So when you get out and get a driver's license, you voluntarily subject yourself to the traffic code of your state. When you join the army, you voluntarily waive your Constitution and Bill of Rights and voluntarily subject yourself to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, called in personam jurisdiction or equity law. You divorce yourself from the Constitution. You divorce yourself from your inalienable rights. And you do so under contract. You get a marriage license. Now you voluntarily enter admiralty jurisdiction. Many patriots will complain about admiralty jurisdiction. Well, have you got a driver's license? Got a marriage license? Got a business license? You volunteered. Businessmen prefer to have a business license so that they can deal with MasterCard and Visa, deal in commerce under the law of merchants, which is what the merchants of the inner city of London wanted when William conquered them. They did not want the common law. today, the merchants do not want the common law, because the common law bans usury and interest. The common law bans insurance. The common law bans banking. Why, you people don't want to give up insurance, banking, stocks, bonds, profits, gains, mortgages, and commerce, do you? Well, that would be unthinkable. Now, of course, if you want stocks and bonds, you've got to have the Securities and Exchange Commission regulating and controlling them. If you want to have limited liability, then you have to have the insurance laws to regulate and to govern the insurance companies and the people that participate in limited liability. If you want to drive on the public highways, then you have to be subject to the commercial laws that deal with vessels driving up and down or operating on rivers of cars, steering around islands and backing up to docks. That's what admiralty jurisdiction is all about. It's the law of the sea, the law of admiralty, and it extends up to the high tide mark. So as a result, there developed in England and America two distinct systems of law and courts, and each of these distinct systems have a peculiar application and jurisdiction. Equity jurisdiction is designated in personam, a jurisdiction in which the individual does not have any rights, just privileges, just franchises, and one in which the individual can be subjected only if he volunteers or gives his informed consent, like joining the army, joining the driver's license program, joining the marriage license program. In equity, there are no jury trials, and the powers of the common law jury to hear and decide questions of both law and fact are exercised by the chancellor. So the judge will tell you plainly, I will give you, the jury, the law. You accept the law from me. I tell you what the law is. Now you see, under the old common law, we really didn't care what the king enacted. If the king wanted to enact seatbelt law, that's fine. And the king certainly had a right to enact a seatbelt law for all of his subjects. Now, a common law freeman was not subject to the king's law. He was subject to the law of God, the common law of the commoners. So let's suppose that the king enacts a seatbelt law and you and I are on the jury. One of the first things that we'd want to ask is, what is the status of this individual at the bar? Is this one of the king's subjects or is this a common law freeman? If this guy's a common law freeman, he's not subject to the king's edict of driving with a seatbelt. He can decide that for himself because he practices strict liability. If, on the other hand, the guy's got insurance and he's one of the king's subjects under a license or a contract, and now all we're really dealing with here is a breach of contract. And when you stop and think about it, when the policeman charges you with a seatbelt violation, he's simply charging you with a breach of contract. See, you got a license. The license is your contract. You agreed under the terms of the license to obey all the laws of the state. One of the laws of the state is that you buckle your seatbelt. So if you didn't buckle your seatbelt, those of us on the jury would have to decide, well, does this guy have rights or is this guy under franchise? Now those questions of law, of course, are now taken away from the jury, and only the chancellor can decide that. The chancellor decides what the law is. That's why pleadings are so important. See, you go into court and you plead not guilty, you plead into the fiction of law that you're one of the king's subjects. And indeed, most Americans are. The average guy today has a Social Security account. He's a citizen of the United States and subject to all the laws, rules, and regulations. Unless you've expatriated, unless you have regained your capacity or your status, well, then in all probability, you probably are in an equity or an admiralty jurisdiction. It's called in personam. Now, however, there may be advisory juries to ease the conscience of the court and determine certain facts, but they're not permitted to hear any arguments regarding the law. controversies are decided by the chancellor, who, besides being the chief prosecutor or inquisitor, can go to any source that he chooses, including his conscience, to justify his decision. Since equity is a voluntary jurisdiction, the parties do not have rights. The Constitution becomes frivolous, and so-called rights in his court are only privileges granted by the state or chancellor, which can also be taken away. Now, in this country, the civil law has always been outside of the common law, operating on summary process in gross violation of our rights to due process. As the common law is absolutely distinguished from the Roman or civil law systems, as reported in People v. Ballard, cited at 155 NS 2nd, page 59. Now, a good example of this separation between the two is contained in the Constitution of the State of Iowa in Article 5, Section 6, which states in part, "The district court shall be a court of law and equity, which shall be distinct and separate jurisdictions." So in Iowa, the Constitution of Iowa separates law and equity. Obviously, they were separated in the state of Iowa. The principles of common law and the principles of equity are those as are distinguished and defined in England. Equity jurisdiction, called chancery jurisdiction in this country, is the same in nature and extent as equity jurisdiction is in England, from which it was derived. All we did was change the name. Now, in our Declaration of Independence, we stated that America had been progressively subjected to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution. Foreign to our Constitution. Subjected to this foreign and alien jurisdiction. This foreign and alien jurisdiction was a jurisdiction of lawless equity out of the Roman civil law in the form of such obscenities as writs of assistance, which allowed summary plundering of the colonists' wealth and substance to the advantage of the East India Tea Company, which controlled the Parliament. Well, we're in the same boat today. It's the multinational corporations like Walmart and IBM and Ford and General Motors that control our Congress. They go in there and they get these laws enacted, which then bring us under this equity jurisdiction called admiralty, depends on how you want to word it, in which we're contractors. We contract into it. We get driver's licenses. I notice the Congress now is going to weigh in on this national identity card. Driver's licenses serve that function, but shortly, when Congress enacts legislation, all of the states are going to have the same standards for the issuance of driver's licenses. I always ask my students the question, why in the world would you want to participate in the driver's license program? Why would you want to participate in the marriage license program, the business license program? Why do you want to trade your inalienable rights for franchises and privileges for which you're subject to these dictatorial powers of the state and the Congress? People look at me and say, well, gosh, it's the only game in town. I say, no, it isn't. The Ten Commandments and the common law and the law of Moses are protected by the First Amendment to our Constitution. We have gold and silver coin. We have just weights and balances. We don't have to deal in banks. We don't have to buy insurance. We don't have to participate in equity and admiralty. We have a Constitution and a Bill of Rights. That's what our founding fathers were concerned about. Today, Americans contract their rights away and then complain about these tyrants in government. They complain about OSHA or the EPA or the State Tax Commission or the IRS. You contracted into the IRS and the income tax with your Social Security. You contracted in to OSHA and the EPA with your corporate charter. So, the plundering of the colonists' wealth and the substance to the advantage of the East India Tea Company, which was the biggest complaint that our founding fathers had, has now been happening today. The same thing is happening in America today with the administrative demands that are made by OSHA, the EPA, the IRS upon non-enfranchised persons. Now, most people, of course, are enfranchised. You've got the license. Now, when you don't have the license, now you got another action. I mentioned this not too long ago. We're talking about the pleadings. You know, let's suppose that an MP came into my office right now and he said, "Hey, Gordon, you're under arrest for being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington." Well, here I sit in Isabella, Missouri. I'm absent from Fort Lewis, Washington. I don't have anybody's permission from Fort Lewis, Washington to be here. And if I walk into a military court and plead not guilty, I plead into the fiction of law that I'm one of the franchisees, one of the soldiers, who is, in fact, absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. What if I'm not a soldier? Shouldn't I want to raise the issue of law? Shouldn't I want to raise the contract issue? Where's my enlistment contract, boys? That's what we call pleading into a fiction of law. All right, we got to take a little break here and give you a couple of reminders. Remember that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School and ask for it. Number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email, send me an email request, or call direct 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Tonight's subject is the common law. What is it? Where does it come from? Who originated it? It comes from the Ten Commandments and the law of Moses. It's the law of the commoners, the law of the common people of England, Ireland, and Scotland. It was codified by Alfred the Great in 872 A.D. And we're taking a look at some of the ins and outs of the law and how it worked and why it worked that way and why it is that we don't have that law working for us today. Now, going on, these writs of assistance, these writs perpetrated by the commercial interests in the Parliament were given authority by an equitable jurisdiction called an assumpsit. The assumpsit, which gave satisfaction pursuant to the customs of the civil law having been voluntarily entered into, had been an old debt action at law, triable by a common law jury, until 1760, when Lord Mansfield, who was the Chief Justice of England, arbitrarily denied trial by jury in assumpsit and removed that action from the courts of common law into the courts of equity under the King's Chancellor. It was there that a jury trial was not allowed, and there was merely a summary proceeding with no semblance of what we know as due process of law today. Let me give you an illustration. You go into an airport and they tell you, bend over, we want you to take off your shoes and we're going to look up your vital parts over here. We're looking for bombs and one thing and another. You know, you volunteer. You don't get a jury trial. You don't get any due process or equal protection. You want to fly on the airline? It's a privilege. It's a privilege. I could do the same thing. You want to come here to school? You know, I could put you through the same kind of search, looking for bombs and protecting you from terrorists that the government does at the airport. And you have a choice. Choice is fairly simple. You just say, you know, you take this school and shove it. You take this airline and you shove it. And you make your choice. Now, in that case, it was called Moses versus McFarland, cited at 2 Burroughs, 1005, is the case that sparked the American Revolution. It caused Thomas Jefferson to say that English law, since that date, should not be used in this country. When they tried to enforce that admiralty jurisdiction here in the colonies, our founding father said, you take that law and shove it. And that's what I'm contending today. We ought to tell President Bush and the airlines and the car companies and everybody else, you know, you just take this and shove it. Wouldn't take them very long to straighten things out. The method of persuading people to volunteer into the civil law in the 20th century is accomplished by social security cards, driver's licenses, and business licenses, and these other contractual entanglements with government. It is by our own consent that we give up our rights, that we give up our inalienable rights under the Constitution and common law for privileges under the civil law of the state. Now, it was this equitable assumption which the Seventh Amendment to our Constitution in the United States was meant to outlaw by specifically providing that in suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of a trial by jury shall be preserved. If this thing is in question of more than $20, the right of a common law jury is to be preserved. Now, you take your credit card, and you got a $10,000 bill, and you say that Visa or MasterCard is screwing you over, and you want a jury trial, and you see what you're going to get. That's why you need to read the contracts that you enter into. Now, a common law free man should be able to live his life from the day he's born to the day he dies, never sign his name a single time. And I remember when I was a child, the very first thing they taught us was how to write our names. Very first day in school, here's how you write your name. We printed it, of course. Little Georgie Gordon. And before long, we were learning how to sign it. And every time we put a paper in, we had to put our name on that paper. The teacher had to have a way to identify that paper. And had to have somebody to put that paper with. So they regimented us in public school. And that's what public school is all about. It's a system of regimentation and institutionalization. So you institutionalize your child by putting him in public school so that you can make him a member of society. Not a member of your family, a member of society. We do the same thing today. You have to sign your name on everything that you do, especially with all of your business transactions with the government, because every one of these business transactions with the government is a contract and a assumption. That's what you're doing. And it destroys your Bill of Rights. It destroys your constitutional protections and guarantees, because after all, it's what you agreed to, and a contract is a law. And what you're doing is you're acting as a lawmaker, signing your name. So, you know, I'm a common law free man, and when somebody says, here, sign here, you know, it's like a red flag. I say, sign? Sign what? Sign what? What do you want me to sign? Oh, I want you to sign this. If I have to sign that, I don't want to do business with you. Now, I have open accounts, charge accounts that I have developed over the years. I've never filled out a credit application with the feed store, and I have credit at the feed store. I pay them, you know, but I don't have any agreement with them. You know, most businesses, most institutions, they don't want to do business with you unless you've got a signed application for credit and they've done a credit check on you and got your social security number and so on. I don't have very much credit and I don't seek it out. But, you know, I went into the building material store one day and I told them that from time to time I need to send somebody in here to get something. And I might not have the money or the time to pay it right now. And I'm going to buy from the guy that gives me the best deal and does business with me. And old Denny said, well, I'd like to do business with you. And I said, you got it. Now, I pay him, you know, every month, and I always take my discounts and all of that. And that's what credit's all about. Credit, you know, is abused here in America. People want credit. And so they go out and they get their credit. And they sign away and then they collateralize their notes. They'll sign on the bottom line and pledge their collateral, pledge their lives. Congress just enacted a new provision with your bankruptcy statute. Now, bankruptcy is a counterfeit of the year of release. All of these, nearly all of these civil law forms are counterfeits of the old common law practice. Bankruptcy is a counterfeit of the year of release, Jubilee years. Anyway, they've changed that, and they're going to make you pay that. There's no forgiveness. No forgiveness of sin, no forgiveness of debt. Not with the Roman civil law, not with the state. So it was this equitable assumpsit which the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution of the United States was meant to outlaw by specifically providing that in suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of a trial by jury shall be preserved. Summary and arbitrary confiscation of income and property is nothing new in American tradition, and its history is from an illicit civil law jurisdiction. So the IRS coming in and seizing your property, or OSHA and the EPA, or airport security, all of these actions and assumptions in reality are the very same usurpations of your rights that our founding fathers rebelled against. The civil law jurisdiction wherein the chancellor enforces the combination of unconstitutional executive and legislative equity is the jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution referred to in the Declaration of Independence. That's what caused the American Revolution and is what our Bill of Rights attempted to protect us from. Now, there is an obvious similarity between the political legal situation of today and the years immediately preceding the Revolution of 1776. So after the English surrender at Yorktown, the Articles of Confederation, that period that followed the conclusion of the Revolutionary War, our founding fathers drafted and implemented the Constitution of the United States in 1787. And in the Declaration of Independence is found the principles of law, but in the Constitution is found the mechanics to protect the citizens from these abuses by government. Now, many states wouldn't accept the Constitution because it did not specifically address individual rights. It was generally conceded, for instance, that the people had the right to keep and bear arms. But these states insisted that it be written into a Bill of Rights. And they also knew that the people needed protection from further encroachments from the admiralty jurisdiction. So the Ten Amendments were added to our Constitution, and that became the substantive rights portion of the Constitution. They knew that even the Declaration of Independence was not descriptive of all of our inalienable rights, but felt it was sufficient to prevent government encroachment upon individual rights. I was in court one day, and I demanded all of my rights sua sponte, and the judge asked me, he said, well, what are your rights that you're claiming, and how many of these rights do you have? How many rights are you claiming? How many rights do you have? Here's the answer. The only rights that you have are the rights that you can claim. If you cannot articulate the right that you're claiming, you don't have it. The burden of going forward is upon the proponent of the argument. Americans have few rights because they, first of all, don't know what their rights are. Secondly, most Americans don't have very many rights because they have contracted them away. When you look in the contract that you made with Visa and MasterCard, you contracted away your Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial in all controversies exceeding $20. When you joined the military, you waived your civil and constitutional rights in favor of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, you have a right to do that, and there's an old principle that we follow in law, and that is, does contract, or I could ask the question this way, does contract follow or supersede rights? Which comes first, rights or contract? And the answer is contract. And the principle is this, every common law free man must have the capacity to impair his rights. Because if you don't have the capacity to impair your rights, you're not free. A free man must have the capacity to enslave himself, else he's not free. But once the free man has enslaved himself, that does not mean that from that point on that he necessarily has the power to free himself. Always liken it like this. Let's suppose that you're not feeling good one day, and you go up to the mental hospital, and you say to the nice lady at the registration desk, "I'm feeling depressed today, and I need to check myself into this mental institution." And then you sign the waivers and check yourself in. 2 weeks later, after you've been on Prozac for a while, you're getting to feel pretty good, and so you say, "Hey, listen, I'm feeling good, and I want to check out." Do mental patients have the capacity to check themselves out of the mental hospital? And the answer to that is no. They can check themselves in like going into a Venus flytrap, but it's got a one-way door. In order to be released, your guardian must release you. So once you make these deals, once you make these contracts with the state, sometimes it's pretty hard to terminate those contracts. And most of you have driver's license, marriage license, business license, social security, stocks, bonds, bank accounts, and so on in your modern civil law way of life, your modern commercial way of life. Those are not commensurate with freedom, and you cannot be free practicing commercial and civil law. The two are not, they're just not commensurate with one another. Admiralty law encompasses all of the controversies arising out of acts done upon or relating to the sea and questions of prize. Prize is that law dealing with war and spoils of war, such as capture of ships, goods, materials, and property, both real and personal. An example is called an admiralty prize action when you're at the airport and you've got $10,000 in cash in your pocket and you want to buy a one-way plane ticket from New York to Los Angeles. And the girl behind the counter reports you to the authorities, who in turn take you into custody and search you and find you've got $10,000 and ask you if you filed a tax return in the last 3 years and where did you get the $10,000. And they seize the $10,000 and develop an admiralty prize action entitled "The State of Maryland versus $10,000. How do you like that? These are called prize actions, admiralty prize actions. You've probably read in Reader's Digest, I know there's a guy that was stopped, a Mexican fellow, and he had $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 in pocket. They seized his pickup, arrested him, and took his money, never gave it back. Now, you can get your money back in a prize action. Most people don't know how. Most lawyers don't know how to get their money back or get their property back in a prize action. It's a fairly simple process, but it requires a burden of proof, which shifts to the other side, and the burden of proof is on you, so you have to go from there. But these are franchise actions. These are admiralty prize actions. They don't have anything to do with your Constitution or Bill of Rights. They have to do with contracts. What in the world are you doing running around with 10,000 Federal Reserve Note dollars in your pocket? You know, those Federal Reserve Note dollars, they say right on the face of them, very plainly, Federal Reserve Note. What in the world are you doing running around here with somebody else's note? It would be the equivalent of you running around trying to buy, sell, and trade and do business with somebody else's mortgage. And so, of course, the authorities are asking you, in effect, what in the world are you doing with $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 or something in your pocket? Why aren't you dealing in gold and silver coin? Why don't you deal in property? Property, you know, is inalienable. Federal Reserve Notes are a franchise or privilege. It's a privilege to have Federal Reserve Notes. And people say, "Well, that's my money." No, it's not. No, it isn't. It's the Federal Reserve's money. And it's a privilege for you to have it. And there are rules and regulations and laws that regulate the use of it. And they come under Title 12 and Title 31 of the U.S. Code. and you have to follow those laws. Now, are you familiar with the laws that regulate the use of Federal Reserve notes, checks, negotiable instruments, mortgages, computer entries, electronic transfer of funds, and so on? Are you familiar with that? Well, you ought to be, because here you are dealing in these types of assets, and they are indeed assets. They're not property, but they're assets. You have an equitable interest in the Federal Reserve's Federal Reserve notes. They're not your notes. It's not your money. But you have an interest in it. And that's because you're practicing the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, if you had those in $50 gold eagles, you'd have an inalienable right. That's money. That's property. So admiralty law encompasses all of the controversies arising out of acts done upon or relating to the sea and questions of prize. Prize is that law dealing with war and the spoils of war, such as the capture of ships, the capture of your car on the highway, goods, materials, and property, both real and personal. Maritime causes is the system of law which relates to commerce and navigation and controversies arising from maritime ventures, which are adjudicated in the admiralty courts. However, a person need not be on a ship at sea to be under admiralty jurisdiction. This admiralty jurisdiction can attach merely because the subject matter falls within the scope of maritime law, such as the use of bills, notes, checks, and credit, which all fall under this jurisdiction. Why do you want to deal in bills, notes, checks, and credit, which fall under this admiralty jurisdiction? Admiralty law grew and developed from the harsh realities and the expedient measures required to survive at sea. It has very extensive jurisdiction of maritime cases, and it has both a civil and a criminal jurisdiction. And because of its origin, because of its genesis, it contains a harsh set of rules and procedures where there is no right to privacy, nor is there any right to trial by jury. In fact, there are no rights under any civil law jurisdiction, only privileges granted by the captain of the maritime venture. When you have a divorce, boys and girls, there's no jury, due process, and equal protection of the law. You have rules. We're going to go under the rules of the state of Missouri. And who is it that makes the rules? Well, the state of Missouri. What's your input into the rulemaking process? None. Well, you got to vote for the legislators. You got to vote for your guardians. It's like checking into the mental hospital. You got to select the mental hospital that you wanted to check into. But, you know, once you've checked into the mental hospital, they all work about the same way. They're all just about the same. Now, for example, in this jurisdiction, there is no such thing as a right not to be compelled to testify against yourself in a criminal case. However, the captain can, if he desires or wishes, grant the privilege of self-incrimination. But there is no such thing as a right to use your property on the public rivers of tar, the highways, but the captain can grant you a privilege to do so. We call those driver's licenses. And there is no such thing as a right to operate a public business, only a privilege allowed so long as you perform according to the captain's rules and regulations. So if you want to open a Denny's in a public business, you have to be inspected, licensed, bonded, and insured. If you want to operate a private business, then you don't have to be licensed, bonded, or insured. You don't have to be approved. But there is a way to do private business. A common law free man does private business with real money and gold and silver coin. He doesn't do business in checks and negotiable instruments and credit cards. He doesn't deal in credit. He doesn't sign contracts with the state or with other individuals. I don't have any contracts out here with anybody that I can think of. I mean, I don't make contracts. From time to time I do. I shouldn't say I don't make contracts. From time to time I make contracts, but I'm very, very cautious about doing that. Because every time I sign my name, I am impairing my liberty to some degree. Every time you sign your name, you impair your liberty. And the more you sign your name, the more you are impairing your liberty. And it gets to the point where, you know, pretty soon you're in a straitjacket. Now, this is the law of the United States. And what's happening here in America is that people, more and more, since about 1900, have become accustomed to practicing this Roman civil law, the law of contracts, the law of maritime admiralty. Maritime law is nearly as old as the common law, and it existed parallel with the common law in England and in Europe, where the Roman civil law was practiced. It is this admiralty maritime jurisdiction of the civil law that has been foisted upon us. The civil law is the law of the ruler. While the common law is the law of the people, the common law is the law of God. Unknowingly, the people have been cunningly coerced out of their common law rights, and they have been forced into this admiralty jurisdiction and admiralty court. Government has corrupted equity as law as well, which has had the effect of denying us or making it almost impossible to exercise our inalienable common law, constitutional, or substantive rights. This admiralty maritime jurisdiction is located under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. And then I'll address more about that admiralty maritime jurisdiction as we progress along in this series. I'll explain a little bit more to you about how it works and why it works that way. But it hasn't been forced or foisted upon us. We went down and signed up for it. I mean, you know, to get a Social Security number, boys and girls, you've got to go down and sign the contract. To become a taxpayer in the United States of America, I can't speak for the rest of you people in the world, but in this country, to become a taxpayer, to become subject to the Internal Revenue Service, you've got to sign up just like joining the Army. You've got to have a contract to do that, and it's called Social Security. And, of course, the government comes along and says, well, this Social Security contract, this Social Security program is a retirement program. And they don't tell you anything about the connecting links with the income tax. They don't tell you about the Social Security number is your taxpayer identification number, and the Social Security is voluntary, and you don't have to volunteer, and that 14 million people in America haven't volunteered. I mean, you got millions of people, Amish and Mennonites and all kinds of religious objectors and just free-thinking people that don't participate in the Social Security program. It's unusual. And in fact, Congress has said the other day, I was just reading this in the paper, you're going to have to show that you have a Social Security number to get a driver's license. Why in the world would I want a driver's license, number one? And number two, why in the world would I want a Social Security number so I could go over here and get a privilege to drive a car? Somebody says, well, I just got to have a driver's license. I just got to drive. Well, you got that when you were 16 years old. I just got to drive. I just got to have a business license. I just got to have a marriage license. I just have to check into that mental hospital. I just have to be institutionalized. I can't make it out there in the world as a free man. Well, we got to leave it right there. We'll be back tomorrow night to take up the subject of the common law. We'll look at it a little bit more next time. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about The Law Hour and The Law School, please go to our webpage. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page at the website georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.